there, and you know, they were living in South Carolina where you didn't require a helmet. And at some point in her life, she switched boyfriends. Let me drop it. And the next guy is a BMW adventure bike rider. So it went from no protective gear to top-of-the-line stuff. Took her out to Duluth, Minnesota, had her custom measured for an aero-stitch suit, bought her a top-of-the-line lid. I'm not sure if it was an Arai or a Shoei, but I mean, no dollar was saved. Yeah, girl had very little response or respect for any of this. She thought this was nowhere near as cool as the previous stuff that she used to wear. Till the day that they went off the road and went down a canyon and threw it up in the bottom and looked at the mangled bike.
Well, it certainly ended well, but, you know, it strikes me as bizarre that people need that obvious a lesson. You know, I understand people have this kind of attitude about nanny states and freedom and rights and responsibilities. If they want to endanger their life, apparently it's their right to endanger their life. But I don't know. Common sense seems to be at a premium these days.
I have to agree. I think that boating is probably one of the last things you can do where you're allowed to make your own safety decisions without the nanny state, but the social cost of not making the correct decisions is just as bad as if you had done the wrong thing to begin self-reinforcing.
Okay, that's good to hear. I've seen way too many people who reinforce bad decisions back and forth on each other. So I'm glad to hear in the water the things work differently there.
Not necessarily.
Well, I agree with the not necessarily. I'm just talking about the average. It just seems to me that it's one of the places where people tend to make, to be encouraged to make better decisions. There, of course, are lots of folks that do not. I'm not saying it's just
another story, Roy?
Yeah, sure, Ed.
I'm active in the Boy Scouts, and one favorite thing is canoeing on the Upper Delaware. And I've taken the Boy Scouts canoeing on the Upper Delaware many, many times. And we make it very clear to the parents, everybody, and that includes any parents who come on the trip, are not getting in the canoe or the raft without a life jacket. If you think you're going to do it without a life jacket, don't even bother starting the car at home. And then you periodically hear how a high school kid drowned in the Upper Delaware, and it turns out, you know, you have to have a life jacket, but you don't have to wear it. And it turns out the kid who drowned always can swim, and his friends tossed him into not wearing it because it's a sissy thing to do.
See, I mean, that's the problem. I don't know. I think bad decisions kind of resonate with certain people and reinforce them. I wish that wasn't the case. Usually, I find that individuals are much more clever than groups of individuals.
And with a batch of teenage boys, that's an intelligence potential wealth.
Yeah, I could see where that would be a problem there. But, yeah, what can I tell you? I mean, human beings, you got to love them. They do silly things many times. Hopefully, we'll learn from our mistakes. Some people just never do. I know people who make the same mistake over and over and over again. So, who knows?
I have another story about a hard hat.
Okay, Ed?
I was working for a company that we were developing some trackside railroads equipment. And Amtrak had us servicing a test site on the then Metro Line and now Excel Track. and we were issued Amtrak hard hats and reflective safety vests, which you always wore that on railroad property. You always wore your safety vest and your hard hat. Turned out, it came in very handy because some public-spirited citizens saw us working track side, called the cops, and said we were dumping a dead body on the tracks. We didn't know this, but we see a cop walking down the path from the road to us, looking very nervous. Sees all the hard hats and safety vests that say Amtrak, and visibly relaxed.
Okay, I guess they must have recently seen Stand By Me.
I'm not sure. This was probably around, this was a long time ago. I guess 1990, maybe 92, 93.
Yeah, I think Stand By Me came out mid-80s.
Bottom line is, a cop going to see a report of people dumping a body is probably very twitchy.
I would agree.
It could have really gotten nasty. He saw the Amtrak on the hard hat to save his ass and said, no, 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 this is ridiculous.
Well, I'm glad to hear that he had common sense.
But see, the PPE works.
Okie doke. Anyway, it's coming up to 10:15, time for Paul and his SpaceNet report. As always, want to thank everyone out there who participated tonight. I really appreciate it, and as I often say, it's people who participate make or break a technical net. No one wants to hear me just moving my jaw. Also, want to thank people showing up on IRLP. We have Barry, Ontario. We have Portland, Oregon. We have Sioux City, Iowa. And welcome to you all. I hope you come back next time we do this. So, again, want to thank everyone. Want to remind everyone that if you have any questions or topics or comments or refutations, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page, I will put up a link, Fred, KQER, sent me a link about how wearing a mask protects you and those around you, so I'll put that up as well. And Mike, KC2NJI, is amateurradio.tv, as always, has archives of the technical net going all the way back to 2006. So avail yourself of that. So thank you all very much. I'll be back to tie a bow on it all, but now it's time for Paul and the SpaceNet Report.
And remind anybody who leaves early, no net next week.
Okay, yeah, I mentioned it a few times during my palabras, but next Sunday night we will be off experiencing the joys of Yom Kippur. I'm being facetious. But we will be off, and we will be back in 2 weeks, and we'll do it again for all you guys and gals.
Okay, Roy, very good. And yeah, we'll be definitely here 2 weeks from now. AC2GSWS2N, very good net so far. And we miss Andy. He's probably listening in the background. Hello, Andy. And he'll be back as well. Let me see what my eye is. Okay. Very good. Just checking the power output here. All right. I don't think I'm going to have all that much tonight, but we'll see. Launch I wanted to watch last week did not take off. Another Starlink mission. That's the broadband satellites that are being put up into spaces. Almost 700 of them up there now, and SpaceX is going to add another 60 of them. And what happened was the launch was scrubbed, not because of the weather at in Florida where it was going to be launched from, but it had to do with the landing pad out in the Atlantic Ocean east of North Carolina. The autonomous landing ship, you know, 300-400 miles to the east of that state. So when they launch, the first stage, which is 159 feet tall, 12 feet diameter, comes flying out of space from 50 miles up and lands vertically on this autonomous launch vehicle that's the size of a football field. And they had to cancel the launch because not so much the weather, but the currents, the high currents in that area. The ship was not able to stabilize itself and stay in one spot. Now, this ship had just gone through upgrades. You know, it had these massive gas power generators on the ship. And each corner of the ship has these, he calls them pods, electric propellers that can rotate 360 degrees. So at each corner, these couple of thousand horsepower electric motors is what, you know, pushes the ship one way or the other, keeps it stabilized so that the booster can come down and land. Well, you know, what happened with all the power, the extra power that he put into the thing, still no good. So he's going to now upgrade them. By the way, he has two of these ships. He used to have one on the Pacific Coast and one on the Atlantic Coast, but now he has both. This is a lot more launches now on the East Coast. So he sent the other one through the Panama Canal, and he's got these but actually folds up because it's so wide it doesn't fit through the Panama Canal. He sent it to the Atlantic Ocean, and that's what he's using, two of these landing ships. Now they're both going to have to be upgraded even more to handle these currents, which he's been doing very good. He's landed, like, you know, over 50 of these things, but he needs to have it more, you know, more reliable. When I say he, Elon Musk, billionaire that's in charge of SpaceX. So that was delayed, and it will probably about another week or so before the currents start to back off. And strong currents tend to, they believe it has to do with these hurricanes. There's another one off the East Coast now. And they'll wait for that to all die down before they launch, I think within about a week. And then following that, there's another one on the manifest. It was actually supposed to go up within 2 weeks. So that one's delayed as well. It's number 13 and number 14. And by the time they finish, they'll have almost 800 satellites up. And he'll have completely be able to cover the whole United States with these satellites. Once it gets up to 1,400, they'll be able to subscriptions to this internet installing system. Right now they're doing what they consider a beta experiment, so they know it's working, but they need to have complete coverage before they can install it. Going to be thousands of more satellites after that launch. He's got permission from the FCC to launch up to 30,000 of these things in the future. So, because of the reflectivity, he's got some kind of sunshade now that launches with each satellite to stop the reflection. He's got them designed where if they start to fail, they will automatically deorbit and then just be replaced by another one. He's running them all on a Hall Krypton. And they're all working right now. They're doing pretty good. He's had to deorbit some of them. But somewhere in the near future, probably by the end of the year, they'll you'll be able to, if you sign up with them, you'll be able to access these satellites from a gateway from your home and be able to have very quick, not only internet connection, but TV. He plans on being able to transmit 4K and even 8K down to Earth. So let me drop it. This is WS2S.
Hey, to Bill Quirk.
That one five kind of quick. I'm in school, but go ahead.
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima. The repeater identified when you were talking about how the units were powered. If you could repeat that, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right after he releases the 60 satellites per launch, which is a little over 30,000 pounds for the whole payload, they all get released. Each one is around 500 pounds. And on each satellite, they have a Hall thruster. Or, each one is an ion thruster using the Hall system. So, for a very small amount of fuel, and they use krypton as a fuel. For a very small amount of fuel, they can maneuver these things around and bring them up to a proper orbit and even change locations if need be. So, yeah, that's what they're using. And then they also can deorbit it using the same ion thrusters. Back to you, AC2PL, WS2R.
All right, Roger. Thank you very much for the explanation. AC2PL, listen.
Yeah, and most of these ion thrusters NASA uses, the European Space Agency uses now, and even Russia, China is now involved with them, are using xenon as the fuel. Xenon is a heavier substance, so it works better to use xenon, but it's a lot more expensive, big time money. With this krypton fuel that he uses, that SpaceX uses, is relatively inexpensive. And when you want to put up thousands of satellites, that's the way to go. So he's got like a factory producing these things. So that's the story on that. Let's see, a couple of other launches that are supposed to go up very shortly. One is the Delta Heavy. That's going to be a National Reconnaissance Office launch, NROL, they call it, NRO, and then there'll be there's a number after it. They've done many, many of these Delta Heavy launches. That's always for the government, usually. And this is going to be another spy satellite, and that's supposed to go off Florida as well. The Heavy are three Delta IV rockets bolted together. First stage is all bolted together, and they have a second stage with a cryogenic hydrogen and oxygen for the second stage. And that will be putting the satellite into geosynchronous orbit, 23,000 miles up. I don't see, they were going to do it toward the end of September. I still don't see a final date on that. But it's always pretty cool to watch. It's pretty thrilling. I mean, there's flames all over the place with the hydrogen gas. It always looks like the whole thing is on fire when the Delta Heavy goes up. Yeah, that's the way it works. Until it clears the tower. And then one right after that, they haven't figured out this launch time yet. It was supposed to be the end of September. My guess is it's going to be beginning of October. Will be the first launch of an Electron rocket. And that's built by Rocket Lab. This guy, Peter Beck, owns Rocket Lab, and he's been launching these things one after the other. Yeah, I think he's up to number 14 in New Zealand. He launches from the North Island in New Zealand. And he's had, I think, 12 successes and one failure. And then And that, now he's back to his regular system, probably once every month or two. But now he plans on launching from the United States as well. And he built the launch pad in Virginia, in Wallops Island, Virginia. And that's all ready to go. And that's supposed to be coming up, I guess, at least within a month anyway. He'll be launching there. An Electron rocket. We call it an Electron rocket because the pumps and the impellers that normally drive the pumps for liquid fuel and the liquid oxygen is usually done by pre-burners, part of the fuel system. He's done away with that. He runs these pumps with electric motors, 50 horsepower motors on each of his Rutherford engines. Each engine is called a Rutherford engine. There's 9 of them for the first stage and 1 for the second stage. But it's run on electric engine, electric motors with each one has a couple of big lithium-ion batteries that are attached to it. And this is an expendable rocket. It goes up and comes down, and it goes into the ocean. And that's the end of these 9 rockets and 9 motors and 9. It's actually over 9 lithium-ion batteries. Up until maybe a couple of weeks from now, I think number 17. Once he gets there around 17 or 18, he's going to try to reuse the boosters. They'll come down, and in the beginning they'll be fished out of the water and put onto a boat and brought back. But ultimate goal is to have a helicopter come by, come down on a parachute. They go by with a hook, and as it's coming down, they'll catch it out of the air and put it back on a ship, and the ship will bring it back to land. So that's his ultimate goal. He'll be able to reuse the boosters. Second stage with the one Rutherford engine, he won't be able to reuse that. That'll be put into orbit and then deorbit after launching its payload, and then it burn up in the atmosphere. Reusability is the way to go. There's quite a few companies that are developing rockets that have some sort of reusability built into the future of these things. But, of course, SpaceX is way ahead of everybody in that regard. Another launch coming up is the Antares rocket on the 29th of this month. So, a couple of weeks now. I'm sure they'll see it today, the 20th. So 9 days from now, it'll be a night launch. Probably see that if you have a view of the horizon, maybe 15 degrees above the horizon. If you can see that, you'll be able to see the light from the engines. There's two RD-181 engines that launches the Antares rocket. Antares is a cargo vehicle. Cygnus cargo vehicle. Will be launched to the International Space Station. It's nothing new, that's for sure. This is the 14th time that it will be launched to the space station. And it will dock with Harmony, one of the modules on the International Space Station. And the astronauts will open the door and unload probably about 7,000 or more pounds of cargo to the space station, food, equipment, science equipment, part replacements for the International Space Station. So that'll be Cygnus, and it'll stay attached for months at a time. Eventually, the astronauts will fill it up with junk and things that they don't need. At some point, it will separate from the space station months from now and burn up over the South Pacific Ocean. Got to get rid of the stuff from the space station. Any questions or comments before I go on? This is WS2M. Okay, SpaceX is sending people to Mars. So presently they have the Falcon 9 rocket, which is up and running. They've successfully launched almost 100 of these things. For different companies they've launched, for NASA they've launched, for different countries, put satellites into geosynchronous orbit. They've put a satellite into an L1 location called Discover that's still sitting out there. It's a million miles away, four times the distance of the moon, sitting there between us and the sun, sending data back to Earth. They've put up the TESS telescope. SpaceX launched that one as well. And that's in a 14-day orbit around the Earth. That telescope goes all the way out to the equivalent of where the moon would be. When it gets out there, the moon is not there, but it's a different part of the orbit. But it goes that far out and then comes back down. Highly elliptical orbit, comes back near the Earth. And as it does, it looks for extra terrestrial planets around stars. So SpaceX has really come a long way. They've done quite a few launches in very unique orbits. We even launched a car into space in the beginning of when they wanted to test the Falcon Heavy, which is three Falcon 9 and Falcon 9 boosters bolted together with a second stage on top, on the middle one. When they first launched that one, nobody wanted to take a chance and put their $1 billion satellite on top. So Elon Musk put one of his Tesla cars on board. Method is to heliocentric orbit, in other words, around the sun. Since that was successful, since then he's launched two of those Falcon Heavy rockets successfully, one for the government and one for the Arabs. He launched a satellite for them as well. So he's really coming along. Like I said, he launches every couple of weeks, it seems like he's launching another Starlink satellite with these 60 satellites for the Starlink project. Eventually, to make money, he needs a lot of money to fund what he's trying to do, which is actually eventually go to Mars. So he's developing another rocket called Starship. Started building these things about a year and a half ago. He started going full blast. He started down in Florida and down in Texas. He stopped building down in Florida and he's concentrating on the Texas project now. He's got a lot of infrastructure there. He's got massive buildings. There's one building that looks like it's going to be about 400 feet high. Looks like that thing's already up all the way and he's not going to finish the walls, complete that. And the idea is to build this roughly 400-foot rocket that he eventually plans on building called Starship. And the first stage will be probably around 250 feet tall. And the second stage will be about another 150 feet tall. And the second stage is called the Starship. And then the first stage is called the Starship Heavy. That will be essentially the booster. So he's actually starting to build that. That part hasn't flown yet, but the other part has second stage. He's tested that without a nose cone or without any kind of wings, but he has flown two of those so far, two different ones. Flew it up around 150 meters high, 500 feet high, translated over to a different landing pad, came down and landed. that he did with another one that he had built. They were called SN-5 and SN-6. Starship number 5, Starship number 6. And then he's now up to Starship number 8. Number 7 is going to be a test vehicle, but he's up to number 8 and number 9, which is pretty far. Number 8 is almost done, what I understand, what I've read. And again, this is down in Texas, Boca Chica, Texas, near Brownsville, near the Mexico border. And SN-8 will be the first one to really fly high. I mean, they're going to send it up 60,000 feet. The initial goal was to send it up like 20 kilometers, but it'll be a little bit lower than that, I think around 12 kilometers. You know, he's going to launch this thing with three Raptor engines. So far, he's tested the other ones, number 5 and 6, with one Raptor engine. Each engine has 450,000 pounds of thrust. So now he's going to have three of these things on the same vehicle that did the hop. Same setup, but this one's going to have a nose cone on top, and it's going to have a wing near the bottom, and it's going to have canards near the top. And the reason for that is they're going to be movable. So after launching SN-8 and going up, 60,000 feet, above where most airplanes fly, the engines are going to shut off, and then it's going to pitch forward, and it's going to come down like belly first, and it's going to control itself coming through the atmosphere with these canards and with the movable wings until it gets down near launch pad we took off from. And then as it gets closer to the Earth, closer to the landing facility at Boca Chica, he's going to reignite the engines and the Raptor engines. He's going to reignite them, swing the bottom, where it comes down bottom first. And then he's got other nitrogen engines, rockets all over to realign itself so it comes down vertically. And he helps to land it. And that's really good. It's pretty much developed. So if they do, I'm sure it will be on the news somewhere, or definitely on the internet. But that would be newsworthy, there's no question about it. The hops were not, did not see on the news, though they were quite impressive. You can still see them on the internet. You bring up, Starship hop, you'll find it real quick. This will be the Starship number 8, and then if it fails, if it comes through the atmosphere and crashes somewhere, it doesn't make it, he's already developing Starship number 9. I guess he's got a lot of infrastructure down there. He's got buildings built, he's got tremendous fuel tanks all over the place, and liquid oxygen. And these are all liquid methane rockets, by the way. Most of your rockets that fly worldwide are run on refined kerosene. They call it RP-1 rocket propellant, but it's really kerosene that's refined for rocket fuel. But he's running these rockets on methane, liquid methane, which is pretty interesting. So let me just see if anybody has any comments or questions. This is WN1. Okay, I don't know if anybody's watched the news. I actually saw this on BBC. And of course it's on the internet. This has to do with Venus. They believe that Venus has this chemical, phosgene gas, in the atmosphere surrounding Venus. And what happened was, it was telescope that was looking at Venus. It's called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii. And it was looking at Venus and studying the atmosphere. And through chemical spectroscopy, they were able to figure out that this gas, this phosphine gas, is located in the atmosphere. And it turns out they needed to get that verified. So they got a hold of the people in Chile. There's the Atacama Desert in Chile. And they have something called a large millimeter array. It looks like a lot of parabolic dishes, so it looks like radio astronomy. And they were able to confirm what they found from the James Maxwell telescope in Hawaii, that this gas is definitely in the atmosphere. But they found this phosphine gas, and after reading these stories, it turns out that this gas can only, as far as we know, scientists know, that it can only be produced by some kind of living organism. They don't know about any other way to do it. They know that Venus has active volcanoes. They know it has sulfuric acid on the surface. They know, they know the pretty good know the chemistry of it, but they can't figure out any way that this gas could possibly be created. And it's in the atmosphere. It's roughly 33 miles above the surface of the planet, floating in the atmosphere. So even though it's like 900 degrees or something, and on the land on Venus, the higher you go up, it's like anything else, the higher you go up. And now the temperatures change, but the pressures change. I think it's something like 90 bar on Venus, like 90 times the pressure that we have here on Earth. So if you go all the way up, naturally that pressure is not there, and you actually have cool, temperatures 33 miles up. So scientists are wondering, could there be something up there in that atmosphere that is creating that gas? Naturally, there's going to be a mad rush to European Space Agency wants to do it, even China wants to do it, but I'm sure NASA is going to jump on board too to try to get a vehicle to investigate the, exactly what is floating around in the high atmosphere of Venus to find out, if there is really some kind of life there. Now, this was predicted. I remember reading this all over 30 years ago. Probably 35 years ago, by Carl Sagan. He predicted this in one of his books. It might have been Cosmos. I believe it was. Probably that book. I'll double check. Carl Sagan, he theorized that there could be some kind of life, floating in the atmosphere. He didn't know, about the gas. He didn't talk about that gas. But that was located there, but he predicted that, that there would be a temperate area high up in the atmosphere of Venus. Maybe there could be life there. So I wouldn't be surprised. And, there's going to be, a man rush to do it. Russia wants to do it. Russia has actually landed vehicles on the planet. Years ago, we sent Magellan there. Magellan is a big satellite launched by a space shuttle, I believe, they sent to Venus. And that was a radar mapping vehicle. Pretty high detail images that came back from that mission that was in orbit for quite a few years doing that. So that's going to be interesting. I'm going to follow the Venus story and see which country gets their act together and sends a probe there first. I know this company I talked about before, Rocket Lab, that launches the Electron rocket. Before this phosphine gas was even discovered, had a plan with a private company to send a very small spacecraft to the atmosphere of Venus. So they might be hurt. You know, I mean, they've actually planned it. You know, you look at like a 50-pound satellite, and you know, something small, because electron rocket is relatively small rocket. You can't put that much payload into space, and then, you know, especially an interplanetary mission. But they plan on doing it. And somebody's going to get there first. Somebody's going to figure out what's going on. And they said if it's not some kind of life in that atmosphere, scientists are going to really be interested in what could be creating this gas. As far as they know, this gas can only be created from some kind of life. It doesn't occur naturally from any other substance. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N.
Yeah, Paul?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, actually, Jupiter and Saturn both have phosphine in their atmosphere. The problem with Venus is it's too small. It doesn't have the gravitational and geological environment for it. There are inorganic ways of producing phosphine gas. It's just we don't know of any way that Venus could be doing it yet.
They found that in Jupiter's atmosphere as well. Well, okay. I'm wondering how it got into Jupiter's atmosphere. Do they know?
Well, yeah. Apparently they believe that the high gravitational field and the gases, they can explain the chemistry involved. It doesn't translate to Venus at all, though.
Okay. I know one of the components is hydrogen. I know Jupiter has an awful lot of hydrogen. In fact, I even think they have metallic hydrogen in the core of Jupiter. So they must have a lot of hydrogen there. It's phosphine, but the other gas is phosphine, spelled differently, mixed with hydrogen, according to the article I read. Somehow you're getting those two together. Okay, but I'm going to be interested in seeing if this is I'm going to roll the dice and say I think there's something in that atmosphere.
Okay, I hope you're right. Phosphine gas is basically a phosphate atom with three hydrogens attached by bonding.
Okay. Somehow it's some kind of a byproduct of life. Maybe they have these, you know, molecular life forms floating in the atmosphere. That would be pretty cool. And if they find that, how did it get there? Did it, you know, somehow, did this life form, you know, get there from Earth? We're so close to it, you know. Did we get hit with a big asteroid one day and something blasted off of Earth and floated over to Venus when Venus was near us? Get caught up in our atmosphere. I could just hear the stories. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2N.
Well, no, I don't have anything extra to add to that. I hope it pans out. And you never know. It might be that life arrived here from Venus.
Okay, yeah. Well, it'll be a change. I used to hear that story up there many times about Mars, right? You know, Mars developed first, and, you know, we wound up getting all their DNA over here. Okay. Very good, Roy. Let's see. There's a European Space Agency launch that got an approval. It's not going to launch for another 2 years, but it's called our HERA, H-E-R-A. And the idea of HERA is to investigate what went on with NASA. NASA is going to launch a DART program. DART is going to be sent to an asteroid with another small asteroid going around it. Well, let's say an asteroid with its own little moon. And going to slam into this moon called Dimorphos, I think it is. And, you know, the idea is to see if anything changes with the two, these two asteroids that are going actually flying together. You know, can we actually affect or change its speed to actually change the timing of when it would theoretically hit Earth? I mean, these are not going to come anywhere near Earth, but you know, the idea is to see if you could do it to change an asteroid, in this case, the double asteroid system. And if it works, the theory goes that you could do it with an asteroid that might be on the way to hit Earth, might be able to, save Earth. Anyway, NASA's going to launch this thing in July of 2021, of next year, from Vandenberg Air Force Base, called the DART, Double Asteroid Redirection Test. And by the time it gets out there, it's going to hit the asteroid at a tremendous speed. I forget what it was, but it's going to be a 1,000-pound spacecraft. It's going to spend about a little over a year, I think a year and a half, in getting there, slam into the moon part of one asteroid is bigger and the other one's small. And then they're going to try to measure it, see if there's any kind of change. I timed it out. But Hera is developed by the European Space Agency, and that's going to fly out there soon afterwards to take a lot of, that's called photographs, and study the impact, the crater that it made. So it's kind of like a combined mission. Missions, but Hera was, they were wondering if it was really going to go on that. So apparently it's funded, and they'll be able to do that. Okay, with that, I really don't have any other topics, so if anybody has any questions, we'll stand by and answer. If not, we're going to turn it back to Roy. This is WS2F. And we'll be back here 2 weeks from now. Hopefully to do the same thing. Tomorrow night we have the Club InfoNet, and that's at 8:30 on these repeaters, and that's always followed by the Swap and Shop. That's always very good to listen to and participate in if you want to buy or sell something. But now I'm going to turn it over to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the space report. And again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight and even people who just listened. We need you as well. Remind you once again, we're going to be off for next Sunday. We'll be back October 4th, the following Sunday at 8 p.m. If you have any questions, if you have any topics, if you have any puzzles you want me to share with the rest of the people, or to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him about some video or YouTube that you saw or website for the SpaceNet report, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the link page, which includes Fred's link that he sent me about masks being beneficial, you can find that at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, Mike, AC2NJI, has his website, amateurradio.tv, where he has archives of the technical net going as far back as December of 2006. As always, I like to close these nets by telling you about a great bit of advice from Dick K2RIW. He closed the net by the line, "Be kind to each other." If it was ever true, and I think it was always true, it's even truer these days. Be safe, be kind, and be well. Have a happy, healthy week, 2 weeks. And for those, have an easy fast. And I wish you all well. And so this is AC2GS, and I will be clear.
WS2NO, one piece of information. I don't know if you have Netflix, but they have a good space type of show. All about going to Mars.
That's time away.
And I think it's 10 episodes. I'm in the middle of it. 10 episodes. I guess this is the first season. Maybe there's going to be a second season. But it's really pretty good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. What's it called?
It's called Away. You know, that's the name of it. A-W-A-Y. Hillary Swank does it, and she's the main person. But they, you know, they have a five-person crew, you know, going to Mars. And if you like the psychology of like, for people to be on a long, extended mission like that, with their families, it's very well done. And, of course, I get a kick out of the technical things of what they do and how they do it. Yeah, that's always fun. Back to you, Ryan.
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they just posted it, started it on September 4th, so I just started watching it. I'm halfway through. It's very good so far. All right, have a good couple of weeks. We'll catch you 2 weeks down the road. WS2N2.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Q2 Tango Alpha Sierra Mobile.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.